Yep. All right. Thank you, everyone. And I'll introduce now the last speaker, Bill.
Bill, I'm switching ear in ear up as well.
Good.
How'd you partner him? It's all over to you then, Bill, yeah?
Yeah, thank you, Baron. Yeah. My name is Bill. I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, Bill. Yeah. Yeah.
Good to be here today, although is it? In fact, about two, three months ago, I got that bloody flu, you know. I had the, and I'd had the flu jab, and it really floored me, you know. So, and I made it stay in at night, you know. And I could get onto online Skype meetings at night, you know, 7 o'clock. I thought, this is it. I was getting to two AA meetings a week, lunchtime, one at King's Cross Tuesday, and the other was a Saturday in Hind Street, you know, the step meeting, and I do service that in that meeting. It's my home group now. So my life was uneventful, you know, it was nice, and I had planned it out, you know. They say, if you want to give God a laugh, tell him your plans, you know. So I had more or less, I thought, this is it now. I have settled out in my age. I'm 87 this year. So, and the thing is, I was, but I was a bit in the doldrums, really, when I look back, you know. And then I got a text from my friend Dennis, who I'd known over the years, you know, and saying that he was coming up here to this convention. Well, I'd come along. And I replied, oh, yes, I would. So anyway, and then I thought, seeing that you're going to, this was a few weeks ago or so, whatever it was. So then I started to go over and see him at his, in his area, you know, the meetings in Barnes and Roehampton. And, you know, and of course, I happen to have a car, and it was just standing, you know, parked outside. So I can use it now, you know, going over there, backwards and forwards, you know, and that. So I'm doing, it's more, I'm more alive now through that. And then get you up here today, you know, it was a shock to the mate there. This morning I was up at 5 o'clock, my God. Yeah, but the thing is that a lot of people go into a vegetable state. So, thank God for AA, you know, that one can be active. Yeah, I ran away from home when I was 15 in Dublin to London. I had sisters and that, and other brothers and sisters in London. And I only started drinking when I was about 18, beer drinker, the weekend. And I got a job in a factory, you know, learning a bit of a trade. It was cardboard boxes, you know, carton form maker. And it was pretty labor intensified. And so the thing is that life was uneventful. And I shared a room with a brother of mine. He'd been to college in Chester. He was going to be a priest. But just before ordination, he pulled out and he came down to London. So he got a job in the city because he was well educated. I wasn't. I came from, you know, four sisters and four brothers, and they were all pretty industrious and intelligent. And I was the opposite, you know. Because really, my ambition when I was young was to do nothing, you know. So that's not right. But I think it was depression, you know. I think it was depression. And then at 30 years of age, I made a geographical to South Africa, you know. I went to a job there. It was a... I lied. I was totally dishonest. I wasn't capable, you know, I wasn't qualified for the job. first of all, it was advertised the foreman in the trade that I knew. I wasn't all that good at the trade, really, even on the bench. So, and then they changed in the meantime to a manager. And I thought, that's great, I'm a manager, you know. I could see myself walking around the factory floor in a suit and a tie, you know. That appealed to me. So anyway, I got there to Cape Town. They paid. It was a lovely trip by Union Castle Line from Southampton to Cape Town. But God, when I got there, I thought, geez, what am I doing here? My stomach was churning over. And as I say, I was a beer drinker, a weekend drinker. But my God, and after a couple of months, they had me up in the office and they said, well, there's a mistake we made here. Well, there was. I was the mistake. And they were quite kind. Today, you know, you can get prosecuted for it, you know. That was... And they were quite decent. They said, right, you know... And yeah, my drinking took off over there. I started then drinking every day and I got soon on to... South African brandy, so really it escalated. And then but they had me up and they said they pay my fare back, but then they said an afterthought that to go up to, they had a factory in Johannesburg, and to go up there. And I thought, oh, that's nice, I'll go up to Johannesburg. Lovely trip on the train, you know. I had a special compartment to myself and a bunk, you know. There I was sitting by the window looking out on the African bush drinking beer. Not a bad life. And when I got to Johannesburg, the manager there, he didn't know what I was doing, but I used to get paid on a Friday. And it was all right, and I was staying in the right boozy hotel nearby. It was the right boozy hotel. That mind you, and I was only there a couple of months, and I had a few drinks, and I went back to the room one night, and I looked in the paper, and I seen a job advertised in. It's called now Zimbabwe, you know. So I sat down and wrote. I was good at writing letters. And I got the job, and they flew me up. What in hell, now I'm on a plane, you know. It was have drink, will travel, you know. And I got the job there, you know. And I landed on my feet. You know, well, yeah, about time, wasn't it? You know, the foreman and I was okay, and he had a big machine. He put me wise to it. You know how to operate it and all, and I was getting good pay. A few months, I was able to buy a car, Austin Cambridge, you know. It was quite new, it was only about 12 months old. So there I was, you know, working during the week, and then we'd go over to, I'd go over to the foreman and his wife and his three children, and they were the drinking crowd, you know, and I was drinking with them and that. And then, in fact, they moved and they invited me to lodge in the house, you know. And I did, I moved in. But really, when I look back, it was a bad move, because I'd run away from an alcoholic home, really. And I didn't know at the time I was moving into an alcoholic home. And it was the wife, the foreman's wife, was the alcoholic, you know. And in fact, her friend, her husband was a printing manager at a factory, you know, they had both been to a grim mental institution in Bulawayo, south of Harare. and they'd both been there. And her friend was more honest. She said she was an alcoholic and she had a big glass of brandy in her hand, you know. And about the foreman's wife, she was more secretive. She said she was there for her nerves. Nerves in my eyes, you know. She was, you see. And I think, you know, you see, it's a family illness, you know. So there, but there was no talk of recovery, and there was no AA. There was no AA. It was called Salisbury then. It was, you know, Southern Rhodesia, you know. But there was no AA, and I had broken down to the foreman one day, and I said I drink too much, and he said, "Ah, no, you're all right, Bill." But I wasn't, you know. You see, it was a problem. And didn't he know that his wife had the problem as well? But in any way, I blotted my copybook there, and as it happened, I had to pack up, and I got back down to Johannesburg. And I finished up in AA there in Johannesburg. And I'd like to say I was a success then. I wasn't, because I finished up in jail after coming to AA. So it wasn't a very good example, you know. Yeah. When I was in the cell, I was thinking, well, how did I... Because I'd left work at 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock, and I was going over to the Boozy Hotel. Oh, yeah, I had been to... AA. I had been to AA. And well, I drank, you know, I'd relapsed. And you see, I was going, and a man pulled out in front of me, and I braked. You know, I avoided the accident. But I had to get out and shout out at him, and shouting at him. And there was a traffic cop across the road. He came over and said, "You've been drinking," and he called it, and I was taken and certified. But I thought, oh, well, I only had a few beers. But then, you see, he came back to me afterwards to say, you know, there's brownouts, and that's things when it comes back to you. That afternoon at work, I'd slipped out because there was nothing to do in the afternoon. I finished the machine. I was doing the record covers, punching them out on the machine. And I had nipped out to the hotel and I had a couple of double brandies, which is, you know, equivalent to 6 tots, or 7-8 tots here. So you see, that's why I... And, you know, I was in the charge room, and it was funny, there was no cells in that police station. And after a half an hour, nobody was taking any notice of me, so I just walked under the counter and out. So that didn't do much escaping, did it, you know? And I gave myself up afterwards. But then they had me up on a charge, you know, drunk, under the influence, drink driving, and escaping from custody, and assaulting 6 policemen. I didn't assault anybody. I couldn't assault a paper bag. Don't mind about. But you see, that's 6 policemen, you get a day. It's an easy day in court, you know. But the thing is, the escaping from custody and so on, really carried a hefty sentence. The drink thing was a suspended sentence, you know, a fine. But in any way, the case hadn't come up at lunchtime, and I said to the sergeant, I said, "This is very unfair, you're throwing the book at me, you know. I could have faced 5 to 10 years, you know." And at that time, in 1963-64, in Johannesburg, in the prison, it was hard labour, sewing mail bags. God, that would have broke my heart, sewing mail bags for getting no money for it either. Hard labour. Which I didn't like, but anyway, they dropped the 2 charges. I pleaded guilty to the drink drive. So you see, the mess one can get into. But I got back to AA, and I must cut this short a bit, the drinking, and I managed to get a year without a drink with the help of some AA members. And I had a spiritual awakening that I was an alcoholic and I belonged somewhere, and I belonged in AA. AA was my family. And I, you know, I was a lapsed Catholic, so the thing is that, yes, I was a lapsed Catholic. But in fact, the man that helped me in Durban, he was an atheist, Jack Pegleg, you know, and his higher power was the electric light bulb. And I thought, well, if that's good enough for Jack, it's good enough for me. But then in that year, I made AA my higher power, God, you know, good orderly direction. And but as I say, I had that spiritual awakening that I was an alcoholic and I belonged somewhere. I belonged in AA. AA is my family. Yeah. After 2 years, I got the sacrament job. and I thought to myself, well, what do I do? And I couldn't be bothered looking for another one. And I had enough money to get back to England. And I paid my own fare this time on a ship. Yeah. So you see, and it shows your higher power was working for me. Because I had a mini car, and also I'd done some service and 12-step work, you know. That was something that also helped me to stay sober. And I had this mini car, and there's a man down in a Scotsman in Cape Town. He said he'd take it over. There was some HP still to run on it. And so when I went down there, he put me up for a couple of nights. And I remember in the afternoon, I think it was, I went down to the front, seafront in Cape Town, and there was a restaurant, and I went in, you know, and it was the afternoon, get some tea and a cake. And all the tables were, somebody was at them. And there was a woman sitting on her own, and I said, well, can I join you? And she said, yes. So I got chatting to her. And she was on the ship that was coming back to Southampton, you know. So it just shows you see how a higher power can work, because we got chatting, her name's Ivy. She was a widow. And the next day I went down to the ship and picked her up because it was being repaired for a couple of days. And we went up Table Mountain, you know. And I said to her, when I go back, join her on the Monday, this was, I look out for you, you know. And so that was good. When I did, and then, you know, because there was no AA meetings on the ship. We didn't have a phone or anything like that. And you know, it said halt, hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. You see, I could have been lonely on that trip, 10 days, 11 days. So we sat at the table at meals, and then we'd go up to the deck in the afternoons and join the activities in the evening, you know. And I remember the first night we went into the bar before dinner, and I bought her a drink, and I said, well, I don't drink. I told her I was an alcoholic, you know. And she said, oh, poor you. So there you are. It was a test of you know, on that ship, because and I shared it, there was a cabin, and I let the other man get out first, and when he got out I got dressed in that, and then I got on my knees. I think that's the first time I got on my knees in 2 years or something like that, and I got out the big book and I read a few pages, and I also had a 24-hour a day book, which I always found helpful. It was written by an alcoholic from the Daytona group in Florida. And it gives you a bit of the top page is alcohol, and then meditation and a prayer for the day. And I asked my higher power to keep me sober that day. So it worked, you know. And I remember halfway through, there was six of us at the table, and there was a man opposite me and his wife, and it was me and Ivy and another couple. And it was his birthday one night. And nobody had ever bothered with the drink, you know, for 4 or 5 days. But that night he had ordered bottles of wine, you know, for his birthday. And he said, "Oh, you must have a bottle of wine. You must, you know." I said, "No." I said, "I can't. I'm not. I'm just toast with the water, you know." But you see, that was a test. And thank God, you see, I got back to London, and it showed me that asking a higher power to keep me sober worked, you know. You see, I experienced it firsthand. And when I was back here in London, I went back to my sister and brother-in-law, and she had twins that were teenagers, and that was in up in Finsbury Park. And I was at a meeting that night in central London. It was off Oxford Street, Great Chapel Street, at the back of Soho, you know. And it was 40, you know, 50 people. It was down in the basement, and all smoking. I was a chain smoker. You couldn't see the other side of the room. And it was great, you know. Great, some characters, you know, that was there I met. Paddy O'Shea, Mick the Tick, Soho Mary, you know. Now, Soho Mary was honourable, you know. It was a bit of a seedy area, Soho. But she had done the teas for 2 years in the French church, Soho Square. And she'd been married to a doctor, but they had parted, you know. Yeah, she was from Tipperary. And there was also another woman, Mary B. She was a Northern Ireland woman. And you see, there wasn't much known about sponsorship then, and the 12 steps and that. And Mary B. had been to America. She knew something about AA and the program, the spiritual aspect of it. And she actually sponsored men, you know. She sponsored men. And she had a little bedsitter at the back of in Manchester Square at the back of Selfridges. And I actually went around there one day, and I was visiting another woman that was in the fellowship, and I thought, well, I'd knock on Mary and just say hello. And she answered the door, and there she was 5'2", and she had the big book in her hand. And I looked in, and there's three men, you know. One was Monty, ex-RAF sergeant, 6-footer, you know, and the other two were 6-footers, and she was taking them through the steps. Yeah, that's, mind you, I should have got her as a sponsor, but I didn't bother, you know. It's a great fellowship, but I was 6 years, 1971, 72, I'd gone through some emotional problems, you know, and I'd seen this older member. He was a gay man, and I had a good chat with him and told him all about what was troubling me and thing. And he told me to write to Dr. Salter, consultant psychiatrist, in the Warlingham Park Alcoholic Unit, you know, so which I did. And I got an interview with him at Croydon, and I spent one afternoon over 2 hours telling him everything, you know. Because you see, I thought he'd wave a wand and I'd come out there different, floating and high, you know. But that wasn't the case. He offered me into the unit. Yeah, he offered me into the unit, and I hadn't had a drink for 5 years. Just to show you how much on the program I was. And anyway, he said, "But you don't have to give me an answer now. Think about it, you know, and you can ring up my secretary. Think about it for give it 2 weeks." But I didn't wait for 2 weeks. I thought, oh, right, because the job that I was in, they found out there was one extra in the department, and so it suited them that I was leaving, and they gave me some extra money as well, you know, for that. And I decided, I had a little Mini, and I'm driving there, and I thought to myself, well, I'm on step one, and step two, they'll return me to sanity. So you had the consultant psychiatrist, and you had the chaplain and the charge nurse, you know, and that. And I'll hand my will and life over to them, and you do a fourth. And I had done a bit of a fifth step with somebody. Now, even before I stopped drinking, I was half drunk with this other AA member and spilt the beans. But anyway, and of course I had the car. I'd hidden away in the car park, but they found out, you know. So you see, I wasn't being dishonest. I wasn't supposed to have a car, but anyway, the chaplain had a garage, and they said I could put it in there, but I couldn't use it for the 3 months. It was a holiday camp, a bit of a holiday camp, 3 months. Because every morning you attended group therapy, 2 hours, 10 to 12. And then you write a left story. But however, I done it. But then they say, you know, I found out later on, when you've done the fifth step, you take an hour's rest and you carry on with the rest. But I didn't. I took a 10-year rest. You know? I wasn't very clever, you know. And that, and it came about. I tell you what, that came about because I had was still alive, thank God. A brother-in-law and sister out in Hertfordshire. They had a Victorian house, and they had seven children. What was it? I think it was seven, yeah. Six boys and a girl, you know. So I used to go out there. And you see, that's where I had the depression, you know. Because at the time, up to then, I was going to AA, and I'd done telephone work in Redcliffe Gardens on my own, you know. And I used to go over there during the week and get some literature for meetings I was attending. And as I say, I done telephone work, which I should have had somebody else with me, but apart from that. But then I found going out and mixing with this family, you know, the boys and that, the depression didn't bother me, you know. So I chose them. And as it happened, they said to me that before I arrived on the scene, the father, he didn't like children, you know. He just didn't like. They told me he used to lash out with them at his foot. So I was welcome. I used to take them to football and to swimming and, you know, and that. And you see, I put that before my recovery, the big book. There's a saying, I heard a saying there, what you put before the big book, you lose, you know. And, I got very involved there for a number of years. But they grew up. And I can remember at the beginning, I thought to myself, I missed out on childhood, I'll have it now. But I was 32, 34, it was a bit late, but they grew up. And the last one, when he was 14, Uncle Bill. It was a big vacuum, you know, and I felt very lonely. And you see, I didn't really. What happened was, I was really a dry drunk. I had neglected. I stopped. I had more or less stopped going to meetings for a few years, and I had stopped being concerned about an alcoholic. I was 17 years without a drink, but my hand was out to pick up at the drink, and that shook me because I didn't want to, you know. I didn't want to. And you see, I got back to AA, and thank God I did. You know, thank God I did. And you see, I was very lonely. I remember I was in my flat above King's Cross. I had a flat above King's Cross, and I remember crying, "Why am I so lonely?" You know, "Why am I so lonely?" And I got back and I met Paddy O'Shea, who I'd been friends with before, and Mary, Soho Mary, and others, you know. And you see, I had thought, at one time I thought, "Oh, I'll get back to AA and I pick up where I left off." But no way, no way. I had to start from scratch again. I went to First London in Baker Street, around Baker Street, and there was a man there, Tony, who I'd seen come into AA years previously, and he had been finishing a year's tea job, and he said, "Oh, Bill, is it a job here for you?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, I'll take it, you know." So I started to get back. And then I met Guardsman John. He had started Emotions Anonymous. Guardsman John. I met him and I shared at a meeting. Oh, he said, "You might need to go through Emotions." So I did. And it helped me, you know, to get back into AA. You know, I remember we had an intergroup meeting and they were making me chairman of intergroup. And I was cuckoo. God bless. So you see, there was a few members, Guardsman John, a few AA members, but there was a lot of them that weren't. They were just had mental illnesses. So, but I declined it. You know, I thought, well, I declined it. Yeah, and but there you are. The thing is that after a couple of years, Guardsman John dropped it and started just concentrating on AA, which I'd done the same, you know, you see. And I remember Paddy O'Shea, when I came back, that was 83, 84. He told me now, like, I was working one week and always said, "Bill," he rang me up, "I've just been speaking to Travers in Bristol. There's a Bristol reunion, you know, on the weekend, and there's a cancellation of the room in the Hawthorne Hotel." And he said, "I'll see you there. I got the room for you." I thought, oh, no option. I thought, yeah. So I finished work at 4 or 5 o'clock Friday. I had a car, but I'd never been to Bristol, but. However, I found my way to the M4 and I headed down. And all he had told me was that it was in the Hawthorne Hotel, Bristol, you know. And I was on the motorway, and when I hit the first exit to Bristol, there's a big banner across the motorway for Bristol reunion, take the next exit. See how AA, it works, you know. I didn't even have a map, I don't think. So. And when I got off the motorway, on the lampposts every so often, it gave you directions. And I got straight to the hotel. And in and so a higher power, you know?
Higher power, definitely.
Works. And then, you know, I went down there with him to retreats. There was Travers and Sally, and he got two young boys at that time, you know. And that was great. I remember at Christmas, we went down there for 6 days. They had a fellowship, you know, over the Christmas, you see. So, that was getting back in. And Paddy O'Shea had been to the previous World Convention in New Orleans, you know. He carried on about the one that was that year, 1985, in Montreal. And I kept listening to him. And then it dawned on me, I said, "Paddy," I said, "I could go to the convention." And he said, "Yeah." and that was a few weeks before it. And he wrote to the GSO in New York to try and get accommodation, but there was nothing. They're all booked up. The whole thing had been booked up. And then I said to him, you know, Paddy, if I went a week beforehand, I'd get in somewhere, you know, and then we could suss things. He always said, yeah. And he said, if you get me a room, I'll come. And he made arrangements to ring him up on the Monday. And I was at a meeting, there was a big AA meeting at that time in Hind Street, Monday night, Akron meeting. It was started by Mary Yes and that. And you know, the meetings in the city at the time, they were run by, they were atheists. And Mary S. had gone down there and spoken about the steps and the traditions and the program, spirituality and everything. And Big Alex had took her aside and said, if you want to speak that language, right, you have to open a meeting in your own area, which they did. They started the meeting, Step 1876 in Hind Street. Yeah, but over in, I got over there, I shared that Hind Street meeting that night, that I'm going to Montreal, but I might finish up sleeping on the pavement. And a member came up afterwards and he said, Bill, he was a member from Hendon, he said, there's a phone number of my nephew. He lives in Montreal. So it just, you know, again, see? And I got there and I got into the YMCA. But they said I had to leave on the Friday, because it was all booked up the following week. So I had a few nights. And when I got up to the room at around 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, I rang this number. And he answered, Peter. And he was on his own. He was a teacher. His wife was French. And the boy, they were in France. And he said, do you want to go to a meeting? And I said, yeah. So he came down, took me to a meeting, first night. And so he said they had a spare room, but he had to wait for the wife to come back to see if it was all right, you know? So I said, fair enough. And I did. I stayed with them there for the week, and I found a room for Paddy O'C, and he was very ill. He had emphysema. And he came over, and you know, that meeting was the opening meeting, was Friday night, the Olympic Stadium, 55,000 people, and it was opened by Lois, Bill Dubbin's wife. She spoke for a half an hour, so that was a wonderful, you know, thing. You see, these are things I nearly missed. I would have been. 1990, a friend of mine, Bill Macbeth, he's gone now, God bless him. He was visiting his sister and brother-in-law in Vancouver. He'd never been there. And she said he could bring a friend. And if somebody else was going to go, and they pulled out because he was buying his flat. And I said to Bill, is that offer open to anyone? I said, yeah. I said, I'll go. All I had to find was the fare, you know. And so he went a week beforehand, and I went the following week, and his niece was in the fellowship, and her boyfriend was in the fellowship. They'd both been married and had children. And Bill was there at the airport with his niece's boyfriend, picked me up and back to the house, and the sister said, I had the lounge and the put-you-up bed and everything, you know. So it was a great experience. And while I was there, there was the World Convention was on in Seattle. So, yeah, and his niece was in the fellowship, yeah. And the boyfriend, he was in the fellowship. But the three of us went down, just Bill, myself, and his sister. And down we stayed in, just outside Seattle. And I went to a meeting Saturday afternoon, It was called the pioneering meeting. And who spoke at that was Dr. Bob's son and daughter, you know? Yeah, they got up and they were related how, when they were teenagers, 14 or 15, that Bill W. stayed in their house for 6 months. He was 12-stepping Dr. Bob, you know, and went up afterwards and shook their hands, and I got their autograph. Mind you, I looked at the big photograph that they had signed. It's sort of faded now. But you see, that was, you know, it shows you and that. So AA, you know, you see, as I say, from that was 35 years ago when I was almost, my hand was out to pick up a drink. And thank God I'm all right today, you know. I haven't veered from AA since then because I know the consequences. God, you know, I don't want to die an alcoholic death if possible. Yeah, the thing is that it's a unique way of living, you know, and it's a good way of life. And so really I live on my own, you know. I'm not lonely anymore. I'm not lonely. In fact, it's been great, you know, since Dennis going over to Dennis and Van. I'm getting lots of hugs from women. My God, you know. You know, I'd be an idiot if I stopped going there. You know? Yeah. Oh, God. Here I am, I was in the flat on my own, and that bloody Skype, you don't get any hugs from, you know, from Skype, you know. You see, the better, yeah, so. Because I've been getting over there, meeting him on his meeting Barnes Friday and Sheen Sunday morning, which he's involved in, and then we go Tuesday, lovely Rose Cottage in Barnes, better area than King's Cross, you know. I'm living it up now, you know. I'm with the the posh. And then we go to a convent Tuesday night, you know, lovely, and Roehampton, you know. So really, I'm blessed, you know. And I believe God has looked after, or she, whoever is God, he or she, that I've been looked after, you see. Because as I say, to live all this long, I never thought I'd live past 35, you know. And I say my prayers now in the morning. If I can remember it, I just finish on this. If I can dwell, you know, with God at the center of my life, you know, and I pray that. I've forgotten the second line, you see. It was there. I was even repeating it on the chair. This is old age, you know, remembering. But and that, you know, God bless that brother-in-law. I remember, I only found out the other day, because I don't go out there at all now, that he's in a home with dementia, you know. And I actually gave him the big book, you know. That was in the 70s. I gave him the big book, and a year later he gave it back to me. I don't think he opened it. So you see, it's being sober, I think, has kept me, and the brain is still. I had the depression. I even was on medication, but I've come off that now. But life is good. So I'm going to leave it at that, Baron. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. It was nice to hear Guardsman's John being mentioned again.
Oh, good.
You know, I had a few hot conversations with him, you know. He was a bit.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and in the Bristol, I remember I went down there, I think the first one was about, I can't remember if it was 82, 83, I ended up living with the nuns, put in a convent.
Oh,
Oh, yes, yes, that's right. Yeah, Mayor's House.
Was that what it was? Yeah. Mm. And it's funny, you don't think about things, it comes back. The thing I've noticed today, like yourself and all the others, how sharp you all are. You know, you're not missing a link, are you? No, it's... It includes you, John, yeah. It's been a nice day, hasn't it?
Oh, it's wonderful, yeah. I'm very pleased. And I must thank Thomas, you know, for getting the lift here. Thank you, you know, Thomas. Great service.
Yeah? Mm. All right, don't forget to bung him.
No.
No, I'm joking. He'd be talking about you. You know, it's like gossip in AA, saying that we ain't got the yellow card nor the serenity prayer, have we, you know? Larry, should we do the promises? Yeah? Yeah. Should we read it or not? I don't know.
Yeah.
Larry, you want to read the promises? I think it's page 82, isn't it?
83.
83, is it? Yeah. Oh, you got it, yeah? You're right to read it, Larry? You got to stand up.
No. 83.
Yeah, 83, bottom right hand side.
If we are.
Okay, got it. Thank you. Larry, alcoholic.
Larry.
If we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We'll not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the words serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we've gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We'll lose interest in selfish things that can gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. We will suddenly realise that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises?
I think so.
They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialise if we work for them.
And Thomas, would you like to lead us out of the serenity prayer, please?
Yeah. We know God as you do not understand you, join in the moment's breath, God.
God, our heart is serenity, truth of things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom
thank you very much.
Thank you. Go on, Bill.
Thank you.